weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to Betty De Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It's Monday, the 12th of September, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, we've the latest on Dundalk Football Club's future, as the club say they've paid their players. In rugby, Hannah Tyrrell previews Ireland's women's clash with Australia this weekend. In soccer, we've Rebecca Cray on the nail-biting title race in the Women's Premier Division. Greg Allen dials in from day one at Golf's Irish Open at Royal County Down. While in our Eye on America, the NFL Network's Ian Rapoport wraps up a dramatic opening weekend in the American football season. If you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200 or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome along. Plenty going on this evening. We're going to start with golf. It is round one of the MGen Irish Open. It's continuing at Royal County Down. There's a group of five players leading by one shot on 3 under. And that group includes Alejandro Del Rey and Todd Clements. Rory McIlroy is 1 under par after 16 holes. And he heads an 11 strong Irish field. Shane Lowry on 2 over after 17. Padraig Harrington finished plus 2. Shamrock Rovers have lost a second appeal regarding their 1-0 FAI Cup defeat to Bowes last month. It concerned the eligibility of Dawson Devoy, who Rovers had argued should have been suspended for that game. We'll have more on that later on. And in the Premier League, Mikel Arteta has signed a new 3-year deal to remain as Arsenal manager until 2027. Rebecca Cray is with us in studio. Rebecca, Mikel Arteta, nice deal for both of them.
Yeah, most definitely. Look, they seem to have a lot of faith in him in the last few years. He's kind of got there or thereabouts. It will be interesting now to see over the coming years if he does produce the goods, but he hasn't so far.
Yeah, he's a fan favourite though, isn't he? Like, they seem to like him, and there's up to now been a bit of patience about what he's doing because I guess they came so close. Manchester City are there and they're a generational team, playing good football as well. So the fans seem to be pretty happy for now, but as you said, how long does this last? He probably has to 2027.
Yeah, most definitely. Look, he's a bit of a character on the pitch, you know, and he's quite, you know, animated on the sideline, and the fans have seemed to invest, you know, all good things in him. So yeah, look, he has them on his side at the minute. I think it's a case now of, you know, off the pitch things don't really stand at this stage, you know, given the time he's had at the club. It's just about proving it now on the pitch. So I think giving him that, you know, extra 3 years or four, sorry, 3 or 2 years on the his contract will hopefully stand to him and see if he does produce it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to turn our attention to the League of Ireland now. So there's been a situation unfolding in Dundalk over the last number of days. Quite a grim one, actually, because they are in serious financial difficulty. It was revealed that their players hadn't been paid. That was up until this morning after it was confirmed that players and coaching staff have been paid. They have received their wages. And to talk us through the latest on that, journalist James Rogers joins us now on the line. James, thank you so much for taking our call. So the latest from when we were deciding to cover the story was that the players have been paid. They've received their unpaid wages that were owed by the club. When did this come about, and how has this came about?
Yeah, well, they were paid the back money, I suppose, that they were owed. It just hit the accounts this morning for both last week and this week. So as it stands, everyone is up to speed in terms of what they're owed, in terms of the playing staff and the coaching staff, which is to be welcomed. I am led to believe the FAI have assisted in that, though. So I suppose that won't go on forever. It's in terms of they've received some advanced payments that they would have been due. And while it's very welcome that they've been paid up until now, you'd have to be worried still about how long this will go on in terms of, you know, will they get paid next week or the week after? And certainly with a few weeks ago of the season, can they reach that point yet?
Yeah, it must be so worrying, really, the situation, isn't it? Because as you said, they're paid till now, but the season isn't over quite yet.
Yeah, it's quite a bit to go. They obviously play Waterford tomorrow night, but even after that, there's another 6 matches to go. And obviously, players are paid up until the end of December as well. So even when the season is over, it just doesn't end there. So, it's going to be a difficulty to get to the end of the season. Talks are continuing in terms of trying to come up with some solution to the problems. But it's certainly uncertain days for Dundalk on and off the field.
And what does it appear to be the solution to the problem? Is it new ownership coming in?
Yeah, well, that is the talks at the moment, that it potentially will be some sort of a takeover. I suppose the issue is with the amounts we're talking here, you're into seven-figure sums. So it's just a case of, will someone be willing to sort of take on that debt, or will it be some examinership process? The likely probably makes the best business sense, but it's far from palatable for staff on the ground, and obviously people who are owed money by the club.
And what's the mood like around Dundalk? Because we know it's such a strong football town. The club means a huge amount to everybody there. And it's just, part of the way of life in Dundalk.
Yeah, it's a lot of worry at the moment. Obviously, I think most, not just Dundalk, but the League of Ireland, I think a lot of us thought we were sort of past these days where clubs could be in trouble and maybe players and staff not getting paid. And particularly Dundalk, where, you know, they had such good days in the not so recent past. So it is one of concern at the moment. I think fans want to help. I know the supporters club did set up a GoFundMe, which has raised around about 16,000 last time I checked, and it's going to, you know, help with this sort of match day expenses. So as I said, the team are in Waterford tomorrow, and I believe their pre-match meal and stuff will be covered by the likes of that fund. So you know, the supporters really, really want to help. They've been here before and got the club out of a real sticky patch in 2012 before the Stephen Kenny era sort of took off. But the amounts now, you could probably multiply them by 10, and it's that bit deeper to get out of them. So there's a real lot of concern about where this is going to go, because, again, a lot of the outstanding amounts that are owed to by the club, their local businesses and local people as well. So there's the double whammy of this as well, and it's hard to see an ideal solution for it, but hopefully it comes.
Yeah, that's a huge consideration, isn't it, as well? The people that are owed the money are local people, so the effect that it has on the town is, it's pretty startling, no doubt. And just in terms of how the club got into this situation, like, there's been so much positivity about the league of late, James, just with the interest and the attendance and the excitement and all that sort of stuff. And now we're in a situation that, as you kind of mentioned there, you'd expect from 10 years and more ago. How did Dundalk get here?
Well, I suppose the peak 6 era was a turbulent time for Dundalk, but when they left at the end of 2021, there was a sum of around about 1.5 million in the bank, and basically, you know, probably trying to still chase the glory days. Obviously, when in Stephen O'Donnell's first season in charge, the club did reach Europe that year, but you know, there's a lot of expense in terms of, you know, chasing that. You see it at the moment already, where, you know, there's a lot of money being spent around the league, and unfortunately, when that's been doled out, it's, you know, you have to bring in finance, and there didn't seem to be a real focus by the club on you know, doing like the likes of, say, the fundraisers that the Sligo Rovers would do. See, they've their annual draw running at present, and it's going to bring in the region of 100,000. So Dundalk probably neglected to do that, and you know, probably bad financial decisions too, in terms of, you know, a lot of players maybe signed from abroad that just didn't work out, and the bills just mounted, and unfortunately, you know, we're in that situation now where it probably has snowballed for far too long. I think it needs probably more fan involvement going forward, regardless of what happens, and that probably was neglected as well, because I think bar maybe opening Oriel Park on a Friday night, there hasn't been an awful lot you know, done to bring money into the club. And you know, as well as that, Oriel Park is a problem in itself, because while you rightfully say that the League of Ireland has, you know, grown in popularity and attendances are up, that probably hasn't been seen in Dundalk, and the facility is a large part to do with that, where it's not an attractive venue really. So it's been a bit of a noose around the club's neck in many ways as well.
And James, when you think of Dundalk, you think of the senior team, but does this have a trickle down then in the rest of the club as well?
Yeah, well, undoubtedly. I mean, Dundalk are one of the few clubs that don't have a senior women's team at the moment, for example, and that was due to come on board in 2025. It had already been pushed back to 2026, and I know you're heavily involved with women's football yourself, and like, there's a great you know, women's tradition in Dundalk in terms of, you go back as far as the likes of Paula Gorham, you know, as recently as 2005, you had a women's team from Dundalk, women to women's FAI Cup. So, you know, women's football is invariably going to suffer. And likewise, when the likes of amounts are owed to, say, bus companies, etc., that has a knock-on effect potentially on your underage sides as well, because they have fixtures to fulfil also. So, it's going to affect every level if the club can't see out the season, not just in terms of the first team, but also, you know, there are underage football or fixtures to, you know, that have to be seen through as well.
Yeah, and we know as well that it's really difficult to attract players to clubs, and we've seen that particularly around, I guess, the Dublin and the wider Dublin, the greater Dublin area as well. So just from a reputational perspective as well, James, this will all no doubt bring issues.
Yeah, well, naturally enough, like at the end of the day, it's an employment for these people, and at the end of the day, when you take a job, you want to know you're paid, and when there's a dark cloud hanging over you from, even if it's a previous regime that, you know, this club or this organisation didn't meet payments, it's naturally enough going to put you off. And you know, that trickles down to, obviously, you know, there is a number of houses in the town as well that the players and staff are residing in, and you know, landlords potentially owe money as well. So, you know, it has a knock-on effect across the board where, you know, when you're trying to do things and like that, they are local businesses that are owed money in the main, and, you know, you still need bus companies, you still need kit suppliers, etc. And, you know, going forward, you know, are they going to do business with you if they've been burnt? And that is a concern going forward, definitely.
And finally, where are the next round of wages going to come from, James?
Well, that remains to be seen. Obviously, the talks are ongoing. It's a sort of very fluid situation where, like, I'm led to believe somewhere between 8 and 10 different parties have spoke to Brian Ainscough in the last sort of week to 10 days. Obviously, some of them would be very explorative and it goes no further. But like, the hope is that someone comes in to at least see it to the end of the season, and then maybe you can worry about next season then. But I think it probably needs to get to a point where something happens and something announces. Now, there's a lot of due diligence to be done, and maybe a lack of due diligence is sort of what got Dundalk here in the first place. So I don't know how quickly that can happen, but the sooner the better, I think, from a, you know, a stability point of view, because it's not fair on the players. Obviously, they're up to speed right now, and that's, look, undoubtedly to be welcomed, but you shouldn't have to be sweating on whether they'll be there next Thursday again.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. James Rogers, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on the situation in Dundalk. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us, though. We'll be hearing from Hannah Terrell about the Ireland women's upcoming rugby game against Australia.
2FM. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Time to look ahead to a big match for the Irish women's rugby team in Belfast. A Scott Beaman's Ireland side take on Australia. It's a match organised to kick off the IRFU's 150th centenary celebrations, but also an important stepping stone for the Ireland women ahead of the upcoming WXV1 series, where they'll take on New Zealand, USA and tournament host Canada. I'm joined by former Ireland international Hannah Terrell to look ahead to Saturday's match. But first, let's hear from Scott Beaman, who named his team selection today and spoke to Michael Corcoran.
Scott, can we just have a chat about the game, maybe the team selection for this weekend? You've been fortunate that you've been able to mix and match, is the word I'll use, between season 15's players and 7's players. So it's, I suppose that the whole idea is to try and get some bit of a combination right in terms of selection, in terms of the starting team and on the bench for this weekend.
I think what we want to do is, you know, we're playing at home in a 150 match. It's a big game. It's a big game for Ireland, for the IRFU, and we want to put a performance out there. We base a lot on how people go in training. We've given people an opportunity to compete their way in, and if you look at the centre pairing, for example, so Enya Breen and Aoife Dalton, they've been training hard, training well. They've been putting those performances out in the intros as well. like thoroughly deserve their opportunity. Then you look at the bench and some of the sevens girls coming back in, reacclimatising to an environment. They've done brilliantly. 2 weeks and you think they've been here months. And so they're putting their best foot forward. So, look, we've got, unfortunately, we've only got a certain amount of people we can pick in a squad. There's a young Kate Hefferman. Kate is training brilliantly. She's going to deserve an opportunity before long. And how we can keep building this group, the more competitive it is to get in, the more better performances we can put out there. You know, we'll start to put some winning performances out there, which is kind of what we're after.
Is it fair to say that, you know, your starting point maybe 12 months ago was at a level where you're starting off this season, if I can call it that, from an international point of view, is elevated to a higher level, so therefore your expectation obviously needs to go up as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't get any easier. WX3 was something of a start point for us, that probably level of opposition we were perhaps above what we played against. But look, we had earned the right to be in WX3, and we said that was the competition we're in, so we'll go and win it. Got some performances out there. Was it perfect? No, but it allowed us to build our performance. Come Six Nations, I think we, against a higher level of opposition, we took a step forward within that. Again, it wasn't all perfect. Now we go to Tier 1, we go to WXV1. The level of opposition that we're against, so whatever game we put out there is going to have to tolerate higher levels of pressure. So as a stepped approach, we're tracking in the right direction towards it. Probably not naive enough to think it'll all be perfect, but certainly from how we've come in, and we're further ahead, we're steps ahead of where we came in last time. So I think we're going to accelerate performance quite quickly. What does that mean in terms of results? Because that's the big question with elite competitions. Mm. We want to be in these competitions, and we want to be able to win games. First of all, we've got to be able to fire shots, because if we don't, we aren't going to win games. Second thing is we've got to be able to keep people out, so that then when we're firing shots, we're in positions to win games. So I'd love to come back. Love to come back, having put some performances out there. We'll be giving ourselves an opportunity to win, and I'd love to get some sort of winning performances out there as well.
Now, people will be familiar with, say, the likes of England and France in terms of a Six Nations Championship, right? So where in terms of that ranking does Australia kind of fit?
So Ireland are currently ninth. I think we climbed up from 10th the other day by not playing. So we're at ninth, which is, you know, we want to, as we get towards the World Cup, we want to track up the rankings. Ultimately, this is about what performances look like in Six Nations and World Cups. This is a massive, massive point for us. So playing Australia on the weekend, I think it's a really fitting level. They're a good team. They're good ballers. Their ability to pass, move a ball around, they're smart. Same as a lot of sort of Australian teams, both women's and men's. They're smart players, smart footy players. So they're going to be able to recognise space and take advantage of it. Our opportunity is to move our defence forward from where it was and to get teams under pressure. So if we're really hard to play against, okay, we're going to be able to get them under pressure. Then the next bit is we've got to get our game going. I think we've got some advantages, playing in Ireland being one of them. So what the weather brings on the weekend, if it's fair, that'll be grand. If it's raining, that'll be grand. We kind of got the game to fit both. So look, we think we've got some advantages in some areas, and looking forward to seeing our girls put that on the park.
That was Ireland head coach Scott Beaman speaking earlier. Also in front of the media today was Australia head coach Jo Yap. And here's what she said to RTÉ's Mick Glennon about the progress that she's seen in the current Irish side.
I think since Scott's come in, it seems to have really settled, and you can see the progress of the girls, and obviously they've got into WXV1 now, which is fantastic for them, and you can really see the growth and they've got a really strong coaching team now, so they look like they're really back on track, which is great to see. Having the opportunity to play against Northern Hemisphere teams is really interesting, because it's quite different to what they face in the Southern Hemisphere, playing against the likes of New Zealand and Fiji. There's much more tactical kicking, and that's obviously quite noticeable from Ireland. So, you know, they quite like a kick battle, so that's something that kind of we're really mindful of. But also, I think the way and knowing Scott, like they like to keep ball in hand too, and like to move the ball and want to create quick balls. So, yeah, we know that we've got to be pretty quick around the corner defensively to stop that.
That was Australian head coach Jo Yap, and we're joined now by former Ireland international Hannah Terrell. Hannah, you're so very welcome. There's a lot of excitement around this game, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Look, obviously, the girls are kind of gearing up for this WXV1 campaign, which will be a huge challenge in itself. But, you know, we've had for the first time now in a couple of kind of cycles, I suppose, the sevens and 15s kind of back mixing in again today. And so the team and squad that was named today has a really good blend of some youth and new cap, but also some experience from both the sevens and 15s side. And I think it's so important for these guys to get as many games as possible together and to continue to grow and develop, as we've seen over the last year. So you know, this Australia game provides a really good test for us to see where we're at, I suppose, going into WXV1. But also, you know, Australia are at a standard that we're maybe capable of getting to at the minute. And so it could be a nice confidence booster looking ahead.
OK, we're going to get into the game in just a few minutes and the team selection. But first of all, Hannah, I was actually reading an online debate today about the sevens and the 15s and kind of the mixing and matching and maybe the lack of cohesion that comes with players who are in and they're out. But at the same time, everybody's Irish and should have the opportunity to play for their country in whatever code it is. What's your thoughts on it?
Look, we had an issue with this probably going back 10 years or so when they decided to split sevens and 15s completely and try to develop them both separately. And unfortunately, that went really well for sevens, but it was probably a little bit to the demise of 15s over the last couple of years. So I actually think right now Irish rugby could be in a really good place developing players as a whole and then fitting them into either 15s or sevens where needed and if needed. You know, as long as the players are kind of all on the same page on the expectations, on, you know, what players could be brought in and you know, won't be brought in or whatever else, and they're all being given equal opportunities to play both, I think it's the right idea. At the end of the day, I would love to have two separate programs and we could properly go off and develop. But we don't have the depth chart that is there to be able to succeed in both and develop both. And I just think it's a great opportunity for us. You know, this is obviously going into a World Cup year, 15s year. So all the focus is going to be on that and players will want to play in that World Cup. So we can use this as a developing year for 15s. And if sevens players are going to help us to achieve and succeed in that and be role models to bring younger players coming through, why not? We saw in the past year with the Olympics that happened and they got a lot of recognition. And hopefully now a lot of girls are looking towards playing sevens. And if we can make it work and everyone's on the same page and knows what the story is around it, I think it's the best option for us right now, purely because we don't have the strength and depth to be able to hold the two separately.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And everybody seems to be singing off the same hymn sheet as well, which is great. And look, you mentioned everyone wanting to see Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe. Well, we're going to get to see her because she is going to feature for Ireland this weekend. Just from the top lines of the team selection, Emer Constantine also back as well. And there's going to be a couple of uncapped players in the team with sevens player Vicky Elms-Kinlan on the right wing and Leinster lock Ruth Campbell replacing Sam Monaghan, who is injured, the co-captain, of course, as well. So look, it's an exciting team as well when you look at it. But just in terms of what this team needs, what are your overall thoughts?
Well, I think Scott probably summed up quite nicely in his interview there, and he's really focusing clearly for me on one big aspect for this team, and that's defence. And so we've probably in the last Six Nations let in teams a little bit too easily. We have all the quality there in our attack. We know we can score tries if we move the ball and play attacking football, but there's no point being able to do that if we can't keep teams out. And in WXV1 we are going to be challenged massively on our defence. So I like that he was really focusing on defence, holding teams out, and then able to, once they have that under control, impose their own attacking game plan on that. It's going to be huge. That team has been picked. Emer Constantine there, like, has obviously done an incredible job to come back in a fullback. Only called up as a replacement and she's starting already. The reason for that is her experience in the backfield. Mm-hmm. Teams are going to try and target Ireland. They're going to try target that backfield. You know, and Emer Constantine is so good under the high ball there. She'd be an experienced voice. Like Scott has obviously seen that there. We need as much experience as possible, having lost, obviously, Sam Monaghan, a huge blow. But like, I'm really excited to see Ruth Campbell, who's a very raw, young prospect who's been doing really well at interprovincial level and with club. I just think Australia are going to be a challenge. They're big, physical girls. They'll be robust. They like challenges. But they're coming off a summer where they got absolutely spanked by New Zealand a couple of times. And there's opportunities here for Ireland if we can actually, as I said, get our defence right, not slip off silly tackles, and then, you know, get the ball to the likes of Amy Lee Murphy-Crowe and Vicky Kinlan, who has a lot of speed and strength about her. And then you look at our bench, Cliona Maloney, Stacey Flood, yeah, Eve Higgins. What's not to like about it?
Yeah, that's for sure as well. There's some really big names on the bench there too. But just in terms of the challenges that Ireland are going to face going forward, and you mentioned there the defence, but for Scott Beamond, he's been in the job a little while now. He's freshened up his backroom team. In terms of evolution, a style of play, what would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to see, if you're going into it a little bit more of a detail of it, I'd like to see a really fresh attack. We've probably focused the last campaign on a kicking tactic purely because we probably didn't have the physicality to cope up front, and we're not known as a team with massive size, but we probably haven't nailed our kicking tactics that time. I'd love to see us actually hold ball in hand a little bit more, try and build up the phases and then create a bit of space going wide and really go after teams a little bit instead of relying on our defence so much by kicking in behind for territory. However, I don't know if we're quite there yet, and with Scott talking about defence so much, I can see him going to the more kicking kind of threats that he has, and backing his defence and then trying to squeak a penalty here and there and take the points and all the rest. One thing I would really like to see cleaned up is our game management. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of times last year in the RDS against Scotland where we had chances to take against Italy. We had chances to take our points in front of the post from easy scores, and unfortunately we decided to kick for touch and didn't get points out of it and stuff like that. And eventually the game came down to, you know, a couple of points here and there. And I would love if we had a little bit more kind of players taking on that role of, let's kick the points here. We could go for a try, but the points are easy ones on offer and we build it up. You wear teams down by that. And I'd love to see that kind of game management by players taking that by the scruff of the neck and go, this is the easy thing to do. This will set us up for the next one and the next one and the next one.
And just getting that consistency and the momentum. And then,
yeah, and confidence growing. And, you know, the players will then take that on. And then we can go for the dagger of the kick to the touchline and try get a try here when they're already kind of chasing the game.
So prediction for a Saturday?
I think it's going to be tight. I'd love to back Scott and, you know, his defence and everything that's going on. I just don't know if they've had enough time together. So I'm going to say 19-17 to Australia, but I obviously don't want it to be that, but my head is telling me we mightn't have just made the inroads as much as I'd hoped.
Okay, well,
but I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah,
I really hope I'm wrong.
You said it, Hannah Terrell. Thank you so much for all of that. Looking forward to that big game between Ireland and Australia at the weekend. We'll talk to you soon, Hannah.
Thank you.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We are turning our attention to the NFL, the new season, and I'm delighted to say that we have a very special guest on today. Ian Rappaport from the NFL Network joins us. Ian, thank you so much for coming on this evening. We're so excited to have you. First of all, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys? Don't mind me. I'll be joining you from a train, so hopefully it won't be too noisy, but it's the middle of the day, so I think this should be good.
That's okay. We have guests who are all over the place, so we often have crying babies, tractors, now we've got a train, so we're okay with any bit of outside noise, especially when you're making such a big effort to come on. So look, we speak about the NFL usually with Jeff Shepherd every Thursday. He's unable to join us, so you're subbing in for him, and that's brilliant. So often when we talk to Shep on a Thursday, Ian, we speak about things, first of all, that happen off the field, because we all do get caught up in the drama and that yep. side of the game as well. So if you don't mind, I just want to talk a little bit about Tyreek Hill and just what's the latest with the situation with Tyreek at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, pretty fascinating situation that kind of took over the football world over the course of the last, you know, I would say week or so, really ever since kickoff last week. When he got, you know, unceremoniously pulled over and then cuffed and then shoved down, and I think we all know the story, you know, by now. So he has been, you know, obviously pretty outspoken about the treatment he received from police. He was cited for, you know, driving erratically, whatever the official charges were. They estimated he was going 60 miles an hour, so it doesn't seem like there was a radar, which is interesting. And the police officer involved has reached out to him to apologize. He has declined. Now, I think one thing we'll see is that Tyreek and a lot of his teammates have sort of rallied about trying to, you know, sort of turn this into a positive and you know, get a better response from police. And I think all of those things, you know, we'll see. Hopefully that comes. Hopefully that matters. But I think that's sort of the next iteration of this whole thing. Is how do they turn this into a positive?
Yeah, there's a lot going on with it, all right. And he's such a vocal individual as well, that it'll probably stay around for quite some time. But there was football played as well, and it is the first week in the NFL. So who were the big winners, do you think?
I would say, first of all, a lot of the teams that, we sort of thought were going to be, in a really good position, the Texans, teams like the Chiefs. I think the rookie quarterbacks were probably the losers, not that anyone's a loser, but, probably the ones who I think left the most to be desired. And then it was teams like the Patriots, which maybe we weren't expecting, who kind of came in right away and, established at least that Gerard Mayo was going to focus on fundamentals and getting them to play better and play right. I think the Saints, Shep's team, were a huge winner. Their offense was explosive. I would say those are probably some examples.
We're quite fascinated as well by Aaron Rodgers, and we speak about him a lot with the Shep. Just in terms of the Jets and the 49ers, how do you think Aaron Rodgers did?
I would say a little underwhelming, his debut, but, there's a caveat to it. And the caveat is he didn't play football for a year, and he didn't really play in the preseason. And so, I think it's, he didn't tell us to relax, but I think that was sort of the indication from him was that we needed to take a deep breath and understand that, this is not going to be the end for him. This is really just the beginning. So I would say, there were some moments they didn't push the ball downfield, maybe as much as they would like. But I think probably more alarming is the defense didn't really stop him. They didn't get pressure, they didn't stop the 49ers, despite a backup running back. And so, they got some work to do, but I still do think they're going to be a really good team.
So what about week two? What should we be looking out for, and what are you looking forward to?
Well, I would say, who bounces back, right? So, the Jets are, a good example. How do they bounce back? How do they prove that they're still one of the really good teams? Cincinnati Bengals would also be in that category. Came out real flat. I mean, Joe Burrow and the Bengals didn't look like they usually do. How do they respond? Those are I'd say some of the examples to me. Baltimore Ravens, same thing. Came out and played a good game, but didn't protect them all well. They got the Raiders this week. What do they look like? I would say those would be some teams to keep an eye on.
Okay, so lots for us to look forward to. Ian, we really appreciate you taking the time. It was so lovely to talk to you. And look, we'll be welcoming Shep back when he does return, but anytime he's not around, hopefully we'll get you on again.
I would be happy to. Hopefully I capably fill in for him.
Super, thank you so much. Thanks, that was great stuff. We're going to take another very quick break. But do stay with us, because Rebecca Cray is standing by to talk us through all the latest on women's football. And we'll also be checking in with Greg Allen.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Rebecca Cray joins me in studio to talk about all the latest in women's football. So, Rebecca, last night there was a couple of games, and it's always strange when you get these Wednesday night games, but when it's refixtures, they're often played when you least expect them. So, two last night. Let's talk about Shelburne and Sligo Rovers last night, and no doubt you'll be happy. Well, Barr having to come back from Sligo, but a really good 4-0 win.
Yeah, really, really clinical in front of goal, which is nice to see at this stage of the season. I think it's something that we struggled with. At the start of the season, just having that out and out, finisher in front of goal. Kate Mooney has been prolific for us in the last 3 weeks. I think she's up to 5 goals now and caught up on Paris Slattery, who was holding the top goal scorer record up until that point as a central defender. But yeah, look, she's been really sharp from the get-go, really, really eager to prove a point and show that she still has something to offer in the game. And obviously, linking in with Noelle, who she would have played previously with in previous Shell's teams, Rowan McLaughlin as well, firing on all cylinders. So look, it was just a really kind of, at times it was tough, very much a mid to low block by Sligo, just set in. Tommy Ewa has them really well drilled in the way they set up, and Miriam Devaney came in there and kind of tried to break things up in the second half, but played a bit more football in terms of Sligo's approach to the second half, but he just couldn't break down that defence, thankfully, and obviously allowed Shells then to make a number of substitutions, given that we've a bit of a break now as well, obviously, and then Cork in the FAI Cup semi-final. So yeah, look, tough old drive home or drive across the country, and I think it was 1 o'clock when we got home last night. So it was tough enough, but look, it made it sweeter given the win.
Yeah, for sure, and we're going to talk about the table in a few minutes, but first of all, Cork City and Galway also played last night.
Most definitely, yeah. 5-2, I think Galway came out on top there. Julianne Russell still flying. she hasn't subsided at all. But look, it was actually quite touch and go, I think, up until the halftime whistle went. I think Galway were winning, and then it came back to 3-2 with Ava Mangan scoring an absolute worldie from, I think, must have been about 40 yards out. Managed to lob the Galway keeper. But Galway's quality just shone through in the end, and they seem to be just taking that pressure on board now that they've, you know, been told that they need to just keep winning to remain on level points with Shells in the league. And it's very much gearing up to be a three-horse race at this stage of the season.
Yeah, it's a really exciting table when you look at it. Shelburne are on top now after last night, so they are just 1 point ahead of Athlone Town, and then Galway United are coming up then just 3 points behind. So 38 for Shells, 37 points for Athlone, and then Galway on 35. But Shells do have two games in hand on Athlone, and or two games more played than Athlone, and one game more played than Galway as well. So that could mean that they could catch them. But just from an excitement point of view, what's the running going to be like, Rebecca?
It's going to be insane, I'd say. Given that I'm involved in it, it's quite, you know, a nerve-wracking process. I suppose it's something that at Shelburne they've experienced before, and given the 2021 year, I don't know if you remember, they were 11 points behind with about 6-7 weeks to go, and last game of the season Pease lost to Galway for Shelburne to win it. So in that sense, anything can happen. Look, Athlone have been going really well, obviously have that two game in hand advantage, have been diminished slightly in personnel given the Chloe Singleton injury. Casey Howe has left. And obviously I think Kerri-Anne Brown now has got a long-term injury given what I've heard. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of maintain that pressure, and how they facilitate their team over the course of the next few weeks. They've got a tough outing now at this weekend against Treaty, who are not, you know, an easy team to play against down there. Really well drilled again. Dominic Foley has them really well set up. They're just in your face, really, really tough. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of result they get there. Obviously, Galway then, they've been doing really well. They had a little bit of a dip in mid-season.
Mm-hmm. They started so well.
Well, flying it mid-season around the international break, kind of dropped off a little bit, and now have just picked it up when it matters most. So, yeah, look, they're away now as well to travel up to Dublin to DLR. So, look, again, another well-drilled team in Laura Heffernan's side, really young. A lot of squad members there, so you know, I think there's a lot of rotation involved in Laura's squads. But look, it'll be interesting to see how they fare this weekend as well.
So just in terms of the run-ins, and I know like a lot can happen in the few weeks, who do you think has the more straightforward one? And obviously then there's a lot more going to come into play over the next few weeks.
Do you know what, I don't think any of the teams have a straightforward approach. You know, like Athlone still need to play Galway the last game of the season. You know, Shells have to play Piemont and Shamrock Rovers. Obviously Galway have to meet Shells as well, so it's going to be very much one of those, you know, last two weeks maybe we kind of might be seeing a little bit more of an open playing field, but I guarantee you that last game of the season for all sides would be definitely one to play or one to watch. I think that at that stage it'd be very much maybe a two horse race. I just have this feeling for some reason, hoping we're on the other side in terms of the good side of it. But and as I said, we have the FAI Cup in the mix of that as well, coming up in the next 2 weeks.
The Women's National League just seems to be able to provide these super finishes all the time. It's probably a testament to just how competitive it is and how many teams are up there competing.
Yeah, Marie, we say it week or year on year how well the league has gone and how much it's improved over the course of the last 11 years or so. And you know, this season for me has probably been the most competitive. You know, you kind of take out maybe the bottom two who maybe haven't been firing at all. But, you know, even Cork have been in the mix there with certain results throughout the season. Treaty, who in the past would have been hopped off, you know, 11-0 and 9-0, all these kind of crazy results. It just doesn't happen anymore. You don't see anything going beyond, you know, maybe 8, I think, is mm-hmm. the highest I've seen. But it's just a consistently really competitive season, and I think it's shown true as well. If you look at Julianne Russell, obviously how she's come back into the fold, and at the international level, you know, she's flying at and probably looked the fittest, to be honest with you, in the previous game she played for Ireland. And that's testament to obviously the work that's been done at Galway. All the volunteers across the leagues have really put massive effort into the league over the course of this time. So yeah, it's really, really good to see.
Do you still think though that players should, okay, the likes of Julianne aside, need to go away to be successful, to get into the international team?
I think at this stage it's still inevitable that girls are wanting to go away and you know, progress in their careers and financially, you know, have that kind of gain. You only look at Ella Molloy has headed off to Sheffield United recently. I think there was talks of Ava Mangan being over at Liverpool, you know, training as well with the first team. So I think that is right now, I can't see anything changing in the next 3 to 5 years, to be honest with you. I'd love to say, yeah, look, we're going to come on leaps and bounds and there's going to be an influx of money from somewhere. I don't know where that's going to come from. I'd love to say it's going to happen, you know, but it's going to take a lot of hard work and investment. And I think for us to come this far, it's taken, what, 11 years? But I think it's still going to be a given that you're going to see girls leaving this league to go further afield to play their football.
I guess when you look at, and you mentioned the possibility of Eva going to Liverpool, but like Liverpool have such a strong Irish presence as well, and you've seen Niamh Fahey signing a new contract there, Leanne Kiernan as well. So it's great to see the club investing in players that have came from Ireland.
Definitely, like Fahey, I think she's got one more year out in Liverpool. She's done great things, obviously captain the side there as well at the minute, and obviously Leanne, then to watch her grow from a player at Shelburne, you know, really timid, really slight, she's now come into her own, obviously has been kind of dampened with injuries over the last little while, you know, and long term at that, but she's back flying now, and I think it's just that little bit of confidence that's been instilled in her playing at Liverpool. They love her, the fans love her, you know, the staff seems to get on great with her, so it's fantastic for them, and obviously having that Irish representation always helps. And you have obviously the likes of Saoirse Noonan as well out at Celtic, who's gone off to a flying start out there, you know, banging in goals, and obviously the usuals in Katie McCabe, and you know, Louise Quinn is still holding strong, and obviously another shout out to her, she's actually announced her partner's pregnant as well. So
I saw that
fantastic.
Next March, news.
But yeah, look, it's fantastic, and look, I would love to see us progress to a stage where we can keep girls here, potentially have a semi-pro league, but yeah, we'll see how that goes.
I guess, look, the Champions League comes into it as well. It'd be nice to see the Irish teams progressing in that. P-Mount did well as well, but it would have been nice to see them go a little bit further.
Yeah, most definitely. Look, they did all they could with what they had. You know, they got a great result in the first game, gave it their all in the second. It just shone through that the Croatian side were fully professional. You know, have won over 24 championships over the course of their existence. I think given, look, P-Mount, they're playing in an industrial estate the last while, you know, and they've kind of just been on bare bones. Fantastic volunteers involved there again, as you know, through the academy, the underage setups, right to the senior squads. But look, again, it just takes that little bit of backing, and hopefully it'll come from the association and beyond.
Yeah, you'd love to see it. We're going to say goodbye to Rebecca now. Thank you so much for coming in this evening. We really appreciate it. And we're going to turn our attention to golf. And I'm delighted to say we're going to cross over now to Greg Allen, who is at day one of the Irish Open. Greg, how has it been?
Well, it's been a good story for Rory McIlroy, not so much a good story for the rest of the Irish players. McIlroy finished with a run of birdie, 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 and he kind of needed to, because when he bogeyed the 14th and 15th, he dropped from 2 under par to level par, and he actually dropped from inside the top 10 to outside the top 30 with those two dropped shots. But the finish of birdies on 16, 17 and 18, and 16 is a short par 4, he nearly drove the green, chipped up to 3 feet, tapped that one in. On 17, a really well played hole, a 13 footer went in for birdie there, and on 18, the par 5, he managed to hole from around 7 feet on the 18th green for a third consecutive birdie. So that catapulted him back into the top 10 from being in 31st position until those rush of birdies, and now he's tied for 4th place, and he's right in there because he's just 2 shots off the lead on that 3 under par 68, tied for 4th place. And the leader is the English player Todd Clements, who's finished with a round of 66, round of the day. He leads by 1 from the Finn, Sami Valamaki, who plays on the PGA Tour, and the Spaniard, Alejandro Del Rey. Both Valamaki and Del Rey shot rounds of 4 under par, 67. And then in the group, on 3 under par after a 68, is Rory McIlroy, who, you know, played a really steady round today, but that finish on 16, 17 and 18, real icing on the cake. So a bit of a change from the start that he made to the Irish Open back in 2015, when he shot an 80 in the first round, 12 shots better today, a round of 68. But there are no other Irish players apart from McIlroy under par figures. Shane Lowry, though, birdied the last for a one over par 72. And we'll hear from him in a moment. But first, let's hear from McIlroy with that round of 68. And I spoke to him afterwards. To finish the way you finished, obviously, you know, to go from outside the top 30 to tied fourth, it's just kind of the start that you need, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think as well, like, it's so bunched, as you said, you know, you're even par and you're 30th and you're 3 under and you're 4th. That's so bunched. It's the way the golf course is. It's, I think, you know, it's hard to go very low, but if you can manage your way around, even if you don't have your game, you can make a lot of pars. So it's sort of going to be, I think it's going to be one of these tournaments where, you know, there's probably going to be a lot of people in with a chance going into Sunday, just the nature of the golf course and how it plays. But yeah, it was great to, after the bogeys on 14 and 15, it was great to birdie those last three holes.
Just finally for me, just the feel of the getting back to links and the, you know, obviously it's a feeling your way into the weekend type of scenario. You must have got that over the last few holes especially.
Yeah, no, it's been great. You know, I came here and practiced and played nine holes on Monday. I didn't come to the course Tuesday, and then I, you know, played the pro-am and practiced a bit last night. So to go out there today and, you know, hit the ball the way I did and play the way I did, it was quite pleasing to see that, you know, some of the stuff that I've been working on this week, I've been able to take it out onto the golf course, and it's felt pretty good.
So that's Rory McIlroy speaking to me just a short while ago. So I also spoke to Shane Lowry. Now, he birdied the last hole, as I said, for a round of 72, but that was in contrast to the start that he made, because he bogeyed two of the first three holes. And this is a really exacting challenge here. Just a bit of wind today, but enough to make it so tough that really only one player has shot a really good round, Todd Clements, with that 66. But he might be six shots off the lead, Lowry, but he seems to be fairly happy with the position he's in, considering the start that he made, that birdie on 18. Did make, I think, his dinner tonight probably taste a little bit better. I spoke to him afterwards. Shane, look, I mean, a start like that, you have to kind of really knuckle down on a test like that. How was that for you?
Yeah, it was, start was pretty bad. Start 5-5-5 was not ideal. And then where I hit it on the fourth obviously wasn't ideal either. So that open down was, like, it kind of gave me a bit of a kick start that I needed, and, you know, a bit of a pep in my step, and I felt like from there I was pretty good, other than the 12th hole, which, you know, I was a little bit unfortunate as well on 12 with my tee shot and even my second shot, but, you know, you got to take it on the chin and move on, and, you know, it was nice to birdie the last. That's kind of make dinner feel taste a little bit nicer. And, you know, you look at the scoring out there, there's nobody shooting really low, like 300 the best score is, you know, even in major championships, people always shoot good scores in the first day, so you can tell how hard of a test that is.
Do you go into a sort of a major championship mode, not just because it's the Irish Open and it means so much to you, but because of the challenge out there, which is almost like a major challenge?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like your pars are good, like, it, you know, and that's the thing. I get off to the start I did, and you have to tell yourself that if you par the next five, you know, start like that, if you par the next five or six holes, you're kind of back okay, you'll be fine. So you just need to be patient out there and need to, you know, miss in the right spot. I felt like the first couple of holes I missed them in the wrong spots, and you know, that you get penalised for that. So but yeah, look, one over is not the end of the world, and we get on and give it a go in the morning.
It was the Irish Open last year which kind of began the run of form which has carried into this year and taken you to the level now where you have real confidence to come back from a bad start like that on a tough challenge. Are you a slightly different golfer, perhaps, in perspective than you were this time last year?
Maybe, like, you know, golf is, you know, a golf career over the amount of time I've been out here is full of ups and downs, and it's a roller coaster. And I've been talking about it a bit with my team this week about when things are going well, you need to just ride the wave as best you can, and when things are not going great, you need to just battle it out as hard as you can. And that's what I'm trying to do. You know, I'm trying to ride this wave of decent form, and, you know, at some stage in the next 10, 15 years or whatever, how long more I play for, it's going to get hard. So you just need to, you know, take the good stuff when you can. And but it's easier when you're having a good year to get off to a start like that and come back from it. That's just, you know, it just is easier. And I did that pretty well today. And maybe I am changing. I don't know. Who knows?
So that's Shane Lowry speaking to me just a short while ago, and he shot a round of one over par 72. There's an incredible round going on right now by 17-year-old amateur from Rogenstown, Sean Keeling played in the Junior Ryder Cup around this time last year. He is compiled a round of 14 straight pars from the first hole. He actually had to hit a provisional ball in the first. He thought he lost his ball. He actually had to hit two provisional balls. But he ended up parring the first hole and the next 13, four holes to play. He's inside the top 30 on level par. Sean Keeling, just 17 years of age. The other amateur in the field, Max Kennedy from Royal Dublin, a fine round of one over par 72. Conor Purcell shot 72. Paddy Carrington, 73. Simon Thornton, also 73. Seamus Power, 74. Gary Hurley, 74. Tom McKibben, a 74, and Mark Power, a 75. Now, one other story today. John Rahm has appealed against the fines imposed on him by the DP World Tour for playing in LIV Series events. Now, he must either pay those fines or appeal those fines to be have a chance of being eligible to play in the Ryder Cup for Europe next year. I got the reaction today of that decision of Rahm to appeal those fines from the Ryder Cup captain, Luke Donald.
From my standpoint, very happy to hear he made that decision. I know he was sitting on the fence a little bit, and I'm in an R-ing, so very glad that he's done that. That allow him to play and create some time for the things in the world of golf to hopefully figure themselves out. So I think we're all being very patient right now. It's 15 months since Yasser and Jay Monahan got together, and yeah, it's been frustrating, I think, for a lot of the players to see how slow everything's going, and I'm sure it's been frustrating for John as well. But I think this hopefully gives some time, for hopefully some things to happen. I've heard in the last couple of weeks there's been a little bit more progress, and hopefully we, it's not fun for me to deal with. It's not fun for anyone to deal with, and I'm glad John decided to appeal and. He can play his events, and which he wants to play and be eligible. Another Ryder Cup means so much to him, so I'm sure that was a massive factor in his decision.
So Luke Donald there welcoming the decision of John Rahm, who just hours from the deadline has decided to appeal against those fines. If he didn't appeal, he would not make it into the Spanish Open, which he needs to play in 2 weeks' time, and thereby have a chance of being on the Ryder Cup team next year. That's how important that story is. Just to tell you that Sean Keeling has now made it 15 pars in a row inside the top 30, level par with three to play. Rory McIlroy is the leading Irish player here at 3 under par, two behind the leader, Todd Clements of England.